Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen cannot be with us on this summer solstice celebration. But we do have a very special treat for you, because the summer solstice will be all about the sun. And for that, not the English newspaper, if people aren't familiar with that, but that big object in our sky. And when you start looking into books about the sun, you will actually find that there are very few of them, but we have a gem in the work called Son of Gods, which is written by Gregory Samsa, and Gregory joins me on the line. Gregory, welcome.
Hello, Philip. It's great to be here on this special day.
Absolutely. Now, before we delve into everything solar and sun related, let's focus a bit on Gregory Samsa himself, because you have led a very interesting life. First of all, people will already probably have heard that you have an American accent, though you are or you have lived for most of your life in the UK, and most of your life has actually been spent bringing innovations, a true spirit revolutionary actually you are, because you have brought about tremendous innovations into the food industry, specifically getting people good food.
That's right. Starting back in 1967, when my brother and I made it our mission to introduce people to the really novel concept at the time that what you ate affects your health. We tell this to people and they'd look at us like crazy hippies, which we were, but we weren't so crazy. And it was a really alien concept that food affected health, and then we had our pitch on what sort of foods contributed to good health and happiness and long life and all of that. But the big hurdle originally was food affects health. It was a new concept. But then the foods that we introduced, such as brown rice and sesame seeds and miso and soy sauce, even things like rye flakes and wheat flakes had never been made before, just oat flakes for porridge. And so there's a whole range of foods that came into the diet. Now there's lots of natural food stores selling these sorts of things. But when we first went to the big health food shop distributor, Holland & Barrett, you've heard of, and they were owned by a big distributor called Brewhurst, and we presented our range of natural foods to their main buyer, who still can't live this down, and he said, "No, I don't think there's any future for natural foods in the health food trade. We'll take the brown rice, but forget the sort of chickpeas and sesame seeds and miso and all that other rubbish. People will never eat it." It was made. But yeah, so that went. It started with a restaurant, though. I think you mentioned on your Facebook page, John and Yoko used to come down. But at the restaurant, people wanted to eat the food at home that they had at the restaurant, so that led to the shop. Then other shops wanted to stock it. That led to wholesaling. And that was a good run from sort of age 19 till 30-something.
So, and a very interesting run it has been. You went from very humble beginnings, from trying to do something, but you have left out one key word which is probably associated with you, and that is called veggie burger.
The veggie burger, I know. All the hard work was the first part, but that provided a platform for the veggie burger, which I created actually as a product to save our company, which was in some sort of deep waters at the time. And I created it, as this, but I thought there was a market for this thing. And there was no such, there wasn't even a vegetarian food market at the time. And I went off and I spent about 6 weeks or more working on the formula. Had a list of possible names from green burger, sesame burger, veggie burger, plant burger, earth burger. And I sort of settled on veggie burger. They all sounded pretty strange at the time, but I'm glad. I think it was the right choice. And that was a big hit. There was a lot of, there was a sort of invisible market out there that nobody had identified. And it brought lots of vegetarians out of the closet as well. People who said, "Shit, now there's a product, I'll be a vegetarian," even though it was just that one product. And I had a wonderful letter from a 16-year-old girl in Scotland who said, "I became vegetarian 6 months ago and I've eaten nothing but pizza since. Thank God for veggie burger. Please send me your recipe leaflet."
But so that, you,
Well, that was also my ticket out of the food trade, because, you know, food, when you have a success, as I learned before with Harmony Foods Whole Earth, it gets big and you need management skills that you might not have, because I was never trained in this stuff. I was run things from the seat of the pants and, you know, powered by my heart, if you like. And with Veggie Burger, I knew, okay, this has got to the point, I'm not the one to be dealing with this anymore, you know, and I sold the company, and it was my ticket out of food.
And then you decided to, because food is pretty much something which we all need. We can't really survive without it. And then the very next big thing is what we all love and which we all see, hopefully on a daily basis, is the sun. And that's kind of like bringing us to what we're going to talk about for the rest of today, because with the new millennium, you decided to also focus on a new aspect of your life, the sun. So, obvious question, why the sun? You call it the white elephant.
The elephant in the room, biggest elephant in the room. And you left out a little bit there, which was my obsession with chaos theory and opening the world's first chaos shop and thousands of fractal postcards and posters and images all over the place. And chaos theory was kind of, I needed that before I could understand the sun or write the book, or, you know, come to the conclusions that the book on the sun took me to. Because chaos theory, I think most people are familiar with it now, but it looks at how systems organize from the bottom up and shows us that the top-down system that we have, you know, where you think, okay, something's really important, you've got to have somebody in control telling us what to do or we'll fuck it up, doesn't occur anywhere else in the universe, whether you look at the termite mound, the rainforest, our solar system or galaxy, you know, all the order or weather system, all the order and structure and often beauty is built from the bottom up. Even our human brains work from the bottom up. And this, you know, my first, this initially I applied to our society, how we run things, which was the subject of my first book, Uncommon Sense. The state is out of date was the subtitle. And so this was important. And it was after a few years after I wrote this book in 2000, as you mentioned, that I started work on Son of God, S-U-N. And that's God spelled with a capital zero, not a capital G, just so people don't get confused with the Christian and Abrahamic God. So, yeah, so that's the introduction. And what you want to talk me to talk about the sun? I had an experience when I was 17 years old in Berkeley, California, where I was standing on top of a hill and staring into the sun. Found myself staring into the sun for 20 minutes, and it was a real epiphany that I did nothing with, because I recognized there was a living spirit there, that it wasn't some accidental ball of gas, but that it was, you know, our most important benefactor, if you like. And I held that for up until the year 2000. It was not something I spoke about, because where do you start? People have had this drummed out of their head for 17 centuries, so nobody really knows where you're coming from. But it did become the subject of my second book. And once I started to study what we know about the sun, it just all supported the thesis, if you want to call it a thesis, that the sun and stars are living organisms, which was something people recognized as the default mode wherever you go in the world, or wherever you went in the world for thousands of years before Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, at which point sun worship or solar reverence of any kind was just burnt literally out of our culture, as I think you know.
So, when you say the sun is a living entity, we're really going back to, as you say, those pre-Christian times and the solar worship. Now, if we open up books of archaeology, we will get to hear that these people were worshipping the sun, sometimes because somehow the sun represented the light of God or some kind of otherworldly reality which was symbolized by the sun. That is not what you're saying.
Well, all we really know about early sun worship is, of course, what the Christians fed us through their filtered heads, whether they were trying to depict it accurately or feeding us propaganda, but obviously they destroyed all the actual materials. I'm saying that it is an actual life form. It's not representative of something else, which is how we sort of interpret those ancient legends, because it's the only way we can. But if you think about what is life, it's a force, it's an energy field. What makes you and I and everybody listening alive is weightless, invisible. It's energy. If you take that energy out, we're worm food. And the sun is one massive, has one massive energy field, taking up more space than the sun itself, the sun's corona. And this is invisible. It's weightless, bar the actual matter that passes through it and becomes the solar wind. And much of the sun's activity is controlled by the corona. Even though scientists say it's the most mysterious part of the sun, they credit it with managing and generating sunspots, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and coronal filaments. And it's our body, as miraculous as it is and wonderful it is as it is, it generates and sustains that life force, that energy. And the sun or stars structures, which are complex, there's seven levels to the star, to the sun. Some of them turn at different speeds to each other. They all perform very specific functions. And the even beyond the corona is the heliosphere, which is another level, if you like. It's a bubble which holds the entire solar system in its embrace. So it's, what is life? Life is energy. And the sun qualifies in even more respects than the earth does as being a living organism. And the implications of that are what most of the book is about, because they're awesome.
So give us some examples of some of these wonderful implications of seeing the sun as a living organism rather than this object which sits there and occasionally disappears and appears.
Rather than the accidental light bulb in the sky which happens to gift us with life. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the realizations, lots of sort of things I'd never thought about before. The energy of life is, of course, recycled sunlight. That's what provides or stores energy in plants that we eat, or that animals eat, and we eat the animals. And that the actual energy of life is solar power. It's recycled sunlight. When you're fascinated looking into a wood fire at night, there's this fascination with fire. And that is stored sunlight being released as energy. So we're actually looking at sunlight being recycled in a fire, one of the reasons it's so magical. When you look at the stars, I'm up in the mountains, or, if you can get to a black space, dark spaces at night, you look up in the sky and stargazing is such a kind of compelling activity. And of course, what's happening is your eye is absorbing the actual vibrations of that star that might have left it years ago. And they're, arriving in the back of your eyeball, vibrating, becoming part of you. That's part of the buzz, There's this, when I wish upon a star, you always wish upon a star because you've got that energy as an ally. And you look at the stars as a life form, then it makes more sense when you find out that almost all stars are binary systems. They turn around each other as they travel through the galaxy like a couple of pair skaters. It makes more sense of the fact that stars live in communities of hundreds, thousands, or 5 or 10 million, kind of like we have villages, towns, and cities. And they're not sort of scattered randomly throughout a galaxy, as you might expect. They live in communities. They all have their own electromagnetic signal that they send out. You can identify a star by its signal, its note, or its fingerprint, if you like. Galaxies all have their own unique pulse they send out, and they live in communities as well. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is crisscrossed with electromagnetic fields linking different stars to each other. We have no idea what's going on in those fields. They recently, with four satellites that detect electromagnetic fields, NASA discovered a magnetic portal that comes off of the sun, off of the sun's corona, and is the diameter of Earth. And this is constant electromagnetic portal connecting Earth to sun every 8 or so minutes. They believe tons of high energy particles pass back and forth between this conduit. Do you want me to go on?
Absolutely.
It's just, and it just, none of this behavior really seems consistent with viewing a star as an accidental ball of gas that somehow is compressed by gravitational pull and spins and gets so hot and dense that a nuclear fusion reaction is instigated. I mean, once that reaction is instigated, it is surrounded by another layer. This is the radiative zone of the sun, which is as thick as gold at its leading edge, or as dense as gold at its leading edge, and the thickness of 25 Earths. And this surrounds the reaction, fusion reaction taking place in the core. The light takes a million years or so to get through that layer, though it starts off as gamma radiation photons, which would turn us to toast. By the time it's a million years later, come out of the radiative zone, it's nice, safe, lovely, visible light. Then in the convection zone around that layer, almost as thick, rotates at a different speed, and that creates a dynamo. So there's this whole working system going on there to produce the energy of light. It's not some accidental light bulb in the sky. It's connected to all those other living beings, and it's also the natural gut feeling. It's what, you know, people in Egypt, Japan, North America, South America, the Norsemen, the Druids, the Celts, the Greeks, the Romans, wherever you go, whatever culture or continent or century you pick, people saw the sun as a life form, and by extension, we now, you know, recognize that all stars, our sun is another star, so that applies to all the stars in the sky. People like Giordano Bruno, not people like, he's a unique person. He was the first person to recognize that our sun was another star, and he avowed that our sun was alive, that all stars were living beings, and that we lived in an infinite universe. You don't hear much about him, but he came between Copernicus and Galileo, both of whom thought our sun was the center of the universe and didn't realize that other stars were suns. Giordano Bruno was burned by the church after 7 years being imprisoned by the Inquisition. And they tied his tongue before they set him alight, lest he try and spread his inflammatory ideas to the gathered crowd.
Mm-hmm. And he was also a person who believed that there actually was life elsewhere in the galaxy as well.
Yeah.
There are various things I want to go back to, but just sticking with Giordano Bruno for a second more, where do you think he got that information from? Was it something he identified by himself, or was he given or a recipient of this information from the old days? Because he was involved quite a bit with the esoteric occult scene at its time, what some people call the Hermetic tradition.
Right. Well, you may know more of the history than I do. I don't know whether, you know, it was his insight into the sun and stars that might have led him to the Hermetic tradition, or vice versa. But I do know his first corruption, in the eyes of the church was when he read Copernicus, got a hold of Copernicus's bound work when he was in a monastery, you know, being brought up in a monastic school. And, you know, you weren't allowed to read this, and he was sort of the guy who wanted to read things you weren't allowed to read. And that got him thinking to the degree that he realized he was thinking dangerous things that could get him in trouble. And he left the monastery. I forget. I don't think he was even 20 at that point, and pursued it. And then that might have then led him to investigate the Hermetic traditions and find out more about it. And he got away with it until he was, you know, lured by somebody he thought was a friend back to Italy. At which, in the first night in his friend's house, the Inquisition broke his door down and dragged him away.
Another example of the good deeds the Inquisition has contributed to the evolution of free thinking.
So we must come in with his statement to the judges when they sentenced him to death, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is, "Perhaps you, my judges, pronounce this sentence with more fear than I who receive it."
Fearless in the eyes of judgment, because he probably realized that they were probably going to be judged a bit more harsh in a non-human tribunal than he probably was judged by a human tribunal.
Well, I think it was he recognized their terror of the consequences of his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, going back to what you were saying about how most stars have a twin, and some weeks ago we had Walter Cruddendon on.
Yes.
and he obviously is a person at the forefront of trying to identify whether or not our beloved son has got a twin or not. So I'm anxious to hear your ideas, your thoughts, and I will phrase this as a question: does our son have a twin as well?
Yes, and it's serious. Walter's right. He interviewed me for a radio program he does on the West Coast. And at the end of the interview, he said, "Hey, I want to send you a copy of my book." And he sent it to me, and I actually devoured it. I'm not very good with books. I mean, really have a dozen books I haven't managed to get through yet. But I devoured his, and he convinced me totally that Sirius is the twin of good old Sol. And that, you know, the position, the relationship between them has a huge effect upon the course of civilization and culture in general, which is something I'd never thought about in the writing of my book. I've actually found so many wonderful things out about the sun since writing my book that, you know, kind of came to me as a result of it. You know, I information that arrived as a result of it.
Go on.
Pardon?
Go on.
Such as, you know, Walter Cruttenton's story, and also the works of the Bulgarian mystic Ivanov, who was led a very large group during most of the last century. But I also want to rewind one point you made earlier on about not many books being out there on the sun. Is when I took Son of God into the Atlantis bookshop, one of the oldest occult bookshops in the country. The manageress, Geraldine, was really excited when I told her about it, and she opened her arms up and said, "We've got this many books on the moon and not one book on the sun in an occult bookstore. It's just extraordinary. Good job the church did, eh?"
Uh-huh. And to a large extent, let's go back into the ancient history a bit more, the ancient civilizations who had these worships of the sun and of the moon. Let's start with Egypt. Egypt, according to the traditional belief of archaeologists, they had a lunar calendar, and then somewhere in the third dynasty, pyramids began to be built, and all of a sudden, solar worship is introduced, the deity Ra steps to the forefront, and pyramids are almost mushrooming out of nowhere across the landscape of Egypt. That's a very dry, a very basic point of view of what's going on in ancient Egypt. What's your perspective on this?
I didn't become an expert in prior solar worship. I mean, I certainly looked into the field, but I didn't delve into it because what I wanted to do more of was integrate that belief with what we know scientifically and experientially about the sun today. But I did, obviously, Akhenaten came to my attention, and who I hadn't heard of before. I worked on the book, and the sun was one of the gods of Egypt, and an important one, and then Akhenaten made it the one and only god, and excluded anything else, which is kind of what the Christians do with their god, is this is the only god, and Akhenaten actually had all the other temples and statues of other gods destroyed, and the priests obviously were a bit pissed off about this going on. He built a new city dedicated to the sun and the new capital, and he was married to Nefertiti. But then when he died, it all went back again. Some say he was the inspiration for Moses. The Egyptians obviously had something strong going, and their pyramids, I expect, were kind of communications devices as well as giant, piles, giant structures. I think they probably served some sort of a purpose. And as I've mentioned many times, I'm sure there's a whole section on building pyramids in the Library of Alexandria when it was torn down in 391 by a Christian mob. So we'll never know how they built them. And in terms of history, I was much more drawn towards Zoroastrianism, because it's an animistic faith religion, recognizes many gods, but also recognizing a one main primary god, which is Ahura Mazda, light itself as a god, as the energy force of the universe. And going from that, you can see our sun is our local broadcasting station of that divine light. So that's why it's our primary god, because, we get our light from there. It's not the primary god, because light itself is. And that's why the Zoroastrians worship fire, because that's sunlight being manifested on Earth. And they've got fires they've had burning for thousands of years. So that was my interest. And then looking at the no-no of sun worship, i.e. the Aztecs, who were sort of ripping hearts out to feed the sun, I was so happy when I discovered that the Aztecs sacrificed fruit and flowers to their sun god. And this was an organized religion and the state. And I had this sort of impish idea that for the Aztecs, they turned sun worship into the need for sacrifices into the weapons of mass destruction of their day. So there's, it was their reason. We've got to have conflict. We've got to have fear, because the sun needs hearts. Today, we have to have conflict and fear because, these Islamicists are supposedly, threatening us. But yeah, that's sort of my history take. I don't know where else you want to go on that.
I like the idea that you're saying that there is this light, which you seem to describe as something which is divine,
yeah,
but that somehow the sun is able to create this, but then also that there are earthly aspects, earthly representations of this light, in fire, or I would call it maybe the modern light bulb. So how do you look upon these various aspects of light, so to speak?
The favorite chapter, actually, in terms of writing it and having fun and enjoying the insights in my whole book is titled In the Light of Intelligence, subtitled On the Intelligence in Light. And can I read you the first paragraph?
Absolutely.
Okay. Light is invisible, yet it allows us to see. light hurtles through space for a year, yet loses none of its energy in the process. Light can be reduced to a single irreducible particle, the photon, and this photon can be in two places at once. We must wait 8 minutes for light to arrive from sun's surface, but the light itself arrives in no time at all. Light gives substance and form to the vegetable world, yet itself has no physical property or structure. Light is a mystery, and becomes even more so as science discovers ever more of its properties. And I can extend on any one of those headings if you like.
But well, how come, and this is more like a rhetorical question, but I nevertheless kind of like hope you can kind of like provide some answer. How come in the 21st century we have no idea what light is?
Because we don't accept, you know, we've ruled out the from our scientific headset, the possibility of anything being conscious other than human beings in this 13.7 billion year old universe, if they're right on that. And so there's argument over, I mean, really argument over whether orangutans and dolphins are conscious of their existence. And many scientists argue that human beings aren't conscious of our existence, that consciousness and free will are illusions. Until they open themselves up to that idea, I mean, it's also light is difficult to understand. I mean, we're physical beings, even though we are beings of light. That's what the life energy is. But we're so tied to the physical world that it's really hard to imagine something that doesn't even need a place to be. Mm-hmm. Light's a vibration. It takes up no space. It has no substance. It can take all sorts of different forms. And it's hard to get your head around. And the one about, you know, we can wait for light. We can wait 3 years for light to come from a nearby star. But light is everywhere at once in its own existence. It doesn't experience time. And that's hard for us to understand how it doesn't experience time. Though it might explain why people come back from near-death experiences and have seen the entire life flash by them in an instant.
And also have seen this surreal, otherworldly light, which, depending on what kind of experience they have, leads them to, I would say, a non-human, non-physical, but definitely very real presence and existence somewhere on what people in the old days called ethereal plane.
Mm-hmm. And also to get back to your sort of original point, you know, how is it that we don't know about more about the nature of light itself, is that the church put a taboo on scientists thinking any such thing. You know, it was anything of a spiritual nature, anything that involved, you know, well, the science branded various subjects occult. And scientists could not go there without risking their lives. Today, they just risk their careers, but that's still pretty scary. And the church opened all the original schools. Oxford was an ecclesiastical university. Schools were run by priests, and they taught kids to read and write, and they read and write a lot of Bible. So it was ingrained into science, do not go here. And they still scoff at things like, you know, astrology and or homeopathy or anything that's spirit related. And I'm just, you know, even letting them think that stars and planets are all dead inanimate balls of gas, they still reject this. You know, they'll accept that a butterfly's wing flap affects a weather system thousands of miles and some months away, a butterfly's wing flap, but they won't accept that the moon, which lifts ocean, or the sun, which, you know, carries all its planets, you know, orbiting around it 500,000 miles through space, they won't accept that that might affect the development of a human being, or a baby fetus. So that's prejudice, and it's taboo, and it comes from the church, and they don't realize it. And that's one of the things, you know, I'd love my book to help achieve, is to get scientists to open their eyes up to spirit, and perhaps they would be able to develop machines and technologies that could give us a better insight into it than we get from, you know, guys in long robes and funny hats reading from ancient books, telling us about spirituality. So yeah, that's why we can do an amazing amount of things with light, but it's as if, you know, we're in a major movie and we're players in the movie, and we don't even, you know, understand the nature of the main player in that movie, the star of the movie, and its product light. It's a situation that I think mankind would really benefit from changing that, getting rid of that old taboo.
Absolutely, and it is really the star, as you say, of the movie. And I also like the fact that somehow science, and specifically the church, was able to, as you say, push the information and the science of light and the sun into occult sciences, which, if ever there was a contradiction in terms, which was worked at, definitely that's one. It. Before we go on to some of the spiritual aspects, I think, of the sun for current times, there's one aspect which I wanted to find out whether you have knowledge or an opinion about, which is that when we look at nature, we see how plants and flora really need the sun. They grow towards the sun, they grow towards light. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, every person of us knows that whether we have studied biology or not. Do animals and humans need this light as well? Or can we literally go and sit in a cave in absolute darkness and will we be exactly the same? Or do we have something vital, something life essential, life essence with the sun as well?
Oh, yeah. The sun is so beneficial to so many conditions, so much of our health, well beyond vitamin D and bones. You know, we don't do photosynthesis, though, you know, some people might think that can be done through sun gazing, but it's healing. They used to design hospitals, or they started to in Germany and Switzerland in the 30s. They designed hospitals to sort of maximize sunlight coming into the ward, because people healed from whatever their diseases were much faster when they were exposed to sunlight. And that all went by the by when they discovered antibiotics, and that cured people even faster, of course, so they didn't need to use natural methods. It lifts our spirits. It makes us feel happy when it's a sunny day. And that's, you know, when you think about that, it doesn't lift our spirits when we turn the heating up and switch the lights on bright. Why not? Why does a sunny day do that? It's because those vibrations are designed to make us feel good, and that's what a plant strive to it. And it's really, really so sad that people are taught to fear the sun today, because it's just the most important thing, not the most important, but it's hugely important to our health. And, you know, we smear ourselves with creams and think it's going to damage us, which is, I sometimes suspect that's kind of the old church. They can't burn you for thinking about the sun being divine anymore, but they can still make you scared of it, and, you know, scared of it burning you.
Mm-hmm. And I also think quite a bit, and this is kind of like tying it back into your 20th century life, which is food. There's an awful lot of sunlight replacement, so to speak. What comes to mind is like chickens who never see natural sunlight but are completely subjected to a artificial life light environment. How is your experience from a food perspective on real sunlight versus anything else?
Well, real sunlight is the deal. I mean, I don't want chickens from battery chicken farms. I mean, it's wild. It just will never pass my lips. I haven't thought about, you know, that's because they haven't got sunlight, just because they haven't got a life, you know, and part of that is never seeing the light of the sun, and they're ducks that never see water as well, and, or the sun in their lives. It's just such, you know, it's such a beautifully constructed world that we live in with soil bacteria processing things. I mean, because that food is all not just our food, but the entire vegetable kingdom is built out of water, air, and sunlight. And what comes out of the ground is just like the vitamins and minerals in our food, you know, a tiny proportion of it, but it's actual, you know, sunlight converting water and CO2 into carbohydrates and cellulose and all the sort of building bricks of the vegetable world. And it's, you know, when we kind of think, oh, it doesn't need sun, it doesn't need all those billions of bacteria in the soil that that have learned how to digest foods and feed them into the tender, you know, the roots of the plants. It's awful, and we end up with artificial people who are just disconnected biologically from the world that they are a part of. And I think it's and when people start eating food that has been fed on sunlight and natural nutrients, they tend to get healthier and happier and clearer and more connected with the planet that is our host.
And which brings us to the missing link, I think, of our existence. And it is June 21st. It is the summer solstice. Mankind has built some of the most enduring monuments to the sun. Probably on June 21st, what comes to mind specifically is Stonehenge, where solar alignments were incorporated to mark the summer solstice. People have been looking at Stonehenge as if it was an astronomical observatory. Some people say that it was built so that our ancestors knew when to plant crops, when to harvest. I personally think it's an awful lot of effort because basically, even on a very basic level, people know when they should be able to plant and when they should be able to harvest. You do not need the sun-specific equinoxes or solstices to understand this. And I think people like John North have been more in contact with trying to get, still from a very scientific point of view, an aspect of Stonehenge in there, which says that actually it's not an astronomical observatory, but it was a religion whereby the sun was seen to be important and whereby people could go. And as you say, and actually this is something in an interview with William Henry many years ago, whereby William Henry was saying how you can go when you are standing in certain temples, whether they're Egyptian or Stonehenge, and when they are only allowed, when they're so aligned that they only allow the sun, the light of one specific star or the sun inside, it is a one-to-one communication almost, a one-on-one bathing of your body with that specific light of that specific star. And the ancestors really chose, almost as if you could choose specific wines and say, okay, today I will have a Bordeaux, tomorrow I will have a Burgundy. They made this specific to the light of stars, that you could have a Canopus light or a Sirius light on a given moment of the month or the year or even of the day.
Yeah.
So going into the spiritual aspect, it all started for you when you were in Berkeley. You were very young. You had this experience. And I'm wondering whether you can give a bit more detail as to the experience you had, but also as to how we can begin to experience the sun more spiritually from today onwards.
I think in terms of connecting with it, is recognizing the nature of the vibrations coming from it, that they're the vibrations of a living being who is our greatest benefactor. I do and did practice closed eye sun gazing, which is completely safe and anybody can do when you just sort of close your eyes and face the sun so your forehead is square with it, and feel the energy, just be consciously bring it into your body and you know, say hello back to the sun, because it's saying hi to us whenever it's out. And there is sun gazing, which, you know, one should go to a proper talk or study carefully before doing, because you want to avoid eye damage. But sun gazing involves straight staring into the sun, as I did when I was a young man. And when it's, you know, for starters, you really should stare in and look into puddles and points where the sun is outlined like a moon, almost behind thin clouds or through trees as obstructed. And you should never need to squint when you do it or have that sort of burn in your eye, like if you've been staring into a light bulb for a while or something. And that's quite powerful, especially if you're grounded onto the ground when you do it. And it's quite a sort of one-to-one connection, and there's not really language going back and forth, but you know, I do find it somewhat inspirational, and I get ideas that come to me in the course of the sun gazing. And I'm not saying they're coming straight from the sun, because I also get ideas coming to me when I'm doing deep meditation. It might disturb the meditation, but there are ideas that come from it. And I think the recognition is the first step. It was like once myself and once people came to our restaurant and they ate natural foods and they say, hey, this is, wow, something's happening here. I feel better now that I'm eating these foods. And that takes them into different directions of being more connected with the natural world and just recognizing that the sun, the true nature of this star of our movie, does lead us in good directions, harmonious directions. And introducing people to natural foods, lots of other people wrote books and plans and this, that, and the other, and opened schools to do massage, and somehow eating natural foods led them into one character in particular. I think Clive used to be a British Railway porter, and he ended up opening a sort of chain of massage schools around the country. And it's just when you get connected with the source, you start doing things that are more in tune with enhancing life on Earth rather than damaging it.
And when we're talking about this essence of the sun, how do you feel? What does it feel? Because as you said, you went into Atlantis bookshop, you saw hundreds of books, or at least dozens of books, on the moon. There's an awful lot of talk about moon awareness, moon energies, but there's also a feeling of the sun, and obviously you're a person who goes out at night as well. What would you say is the distinguishing factors between both objects? Why, what are the key differentiators between those two?
Well, one is a source of light and the other is reflected light. But it's reflected sunlight, so it's been qualitatively changed by coming off the moon. And it's just light itself is such, yeah, it's such amazing stuff. The more you think about it, the more just mind-boggling it is. And you know, we have in our language so many terms that refer to light. You know, we talk about in the light of intelligence and shedding light on things. And, you know, we revere divine light and we seek enlightenment. When people die, the lights go up. When we're really feeling alive, we're all lit up or we're fired up. And good ideas are brilliant. And people are delighted when they're feeling really happy. And all these sort of words incorporate light into them. And it's like we know in our language that light is this ultimate intelligent being. And it really does strike me that whilst we look at, or for a long time we saw atoms as the building blocks of matter, the smallest bit of matter, I see photons as the building bricks of intelligence, as the sort of single smallest unit there is of intelligence. And any photon is capable of carrying information that no other photon has carried before. It's just, you know, this mechanics of how we see things.
And now the foreword of your book is written by Graham Hancock, and Graham in his foreword goes on to his own ayahuasca experiences. And when you were talking about light and how really it is the essence and is an information carrier, in our archives, listeners can also go to the Jeremy Narby interview, which we will actually repeat over the summer as we go on occasional breaks. But Jeremy Narby is basically the person who identified that inside DNA itself there was not only intelligence, but also that when people connected to this intelligence, that actually it was a light intelligence. And he then goes on to actually give the latest evidence, which actually suggests that DNA gives a very measurable aspect of light off, visibly measurable by scientific instruments. Yeah. So this light is really all around us, and almost like the vision you have is that somehow if you were able to nurture this, you do become like Neo in the Matrix, whereby you literally begin to shine from the inside out and become a enlightened human being.
Yeah, I think that stacks up. And as you're saying, our DNA, our cells do communicate with light. I mean, we are that is the energy of life is going through our body, and some of it we're not even aware of the communications, but light is used because that's how intelligence communicates. And we can pack more data into light than we can into wires, which is why optic cables, you know, one optic cable could contain all the internet conversation, internet traffic in the world. You know, it's just because you can compress light infinitely. It's it really is the stuff of life.
And it's also, to some extent, the ultimate technology. It's a technology which we haven't been using. And I quite often think that when you look at some of the inroads which people like Paul Devereux are making with acoustic interest in archaeology, and they're beginning to find out how some of these ancient temples actually had acoustic properties, which only now we're beginning to understand.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to have been looking at light at all, yet we all know that these ancient temples were specifically aligned to the sun.
Yeah, I have met several people who were involved in or are involved in studying ancient solar technology, who don't recognize that stars, you know, are living beings. And when Jonathan Kaner, this country's most famous astrologer, listened to one of my talks, he came up afterwards, took the microphone and said, you know, you hear about people who go to a party and they take a pill and their lives are changed forever. Well, listening to Greg's lecture, I just took that pill. Because here he is, a sun sign astrologer, and he never realized the obvious. And once he got it, he got it. But it is. It's just been so burnt out of the culture that people don't think about it, and or about the nature of light. And it's as if, you know, all our wonderful technology today is missing a really important spiritual underpinning, and that's just so important to the future of our race.
Absolutely, and we hope that this broadcast of the Spiritual Revolution has really made a first step into putting the sun back where it belongs, namely brightly shining in the sky, and for people to begin to understand that it is actually far more than just a piece of physical events happening there, that there is far more to this than that. And what better way to do this than on the summer solstice? So, Gregory, thank you for being our guest. If you want to learn anything more about Gregory Sams, please go to his website, which is gregorysams.com, which is GregorySams.com. That's GregorySams.com. If you are interested to hear once again this interview from the very first second, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to iTunes, where we have more than a year's worth of interviews available. You can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com, where you will be able to listen to the last 5 episodes of The Spirit Revolution. You can also go to the BBS Radio Archives, where you will be able to listen to every single episode of The Spirit Revolution, as well as many other shows which are hosted on BBS Radio channels. But until next time, from Kathleen, who was unfortunately unable to be with us this week, until the next time, the truth against the world.